you, Gene. Appreciate you getting us kicked off today. I think we have a very exciting topic to discuss today and the really excellent presenters, so I'm glad everyone is joining us. As my slides are loading here, Gene didn't actually say who I am. I'm Michelle Mahoney. I work in EPA's Superfund office, in the same office as Gene, actually. We're just in different branches. I work on technology transfer and technology assessment for cleaning up mining sites. And I manage the content that is presented on this slide here at this website, cluin.org/mining, where we have lots of information on all of the webinars that we've done. As Gene mentioned, this is part of a series. And as you see on the slide here, there are links where you can go to view all of the archives of previous webinars. And we started this back in 2012, so there's quite a few up there. You can also get information on cleanup technologies and other meetings going on around the world. So I would encourage you all to visit this webpage. So today is a part of a series, as we said, and this is a list of some of the archives that we have from past seminars, and here is the direct link to get to that list of archives. So if you're interested in seeing what else we have presented in the past, please check it out. I think you'll find some very useful topics that have been presented over the years. And if anyone has any suggestions for future topics or speakers, please feel free to get in touch with me. Our goal is to do a mining-related webinar on Cluin every quarter. So that's 4 per year. So please send me any suggestions that you have or respond with the feedback that Gene shares with you at the end of this webinar. So I'm very excited about today's topic. Our title is Considerations for Bulkheading Draining Mine Tunnels. And during this webinar, we're going to address underground bulkheads and present specific examples from EPA's Region 8, where they've done some bulkhead installations and water quality changes, including the De Niro Tunnel, the Pennsylvania Mines, and Captain Jack Mill site. We have 3 presenters today, and we're very fortunate that they're all in the room together interacting. Our first presenter is Christoph Goss. And he's a principal at Deere and All Consultants in Longmont, Colorado. His practice includes tunneling, underground mine design, and underground rehabilitation. For pretty much 20 years, he's been working on a variety of abandoned mines and water tunnels, evaluating and designing support rehabilitation and bulkheads. We're very glad to have him here as a presenter. Our second presenter today, or one of our presenters today, is Joy Jenkins. And she's a remedial project manager in EPA's Region 8 office. She's worked as a consulting environmental engineer prior to joining EPA. And Joy is the RPM for the Captain Jack Mill and Nelson Tunnel in Colorado and the Gill Edge Mine in South Dakota. And then the third presenter we have today is Jeff Graves. And Jeff has been with the state of Colorado for 18 years, where he's designed and implemented numerous mine reclamation projects for the state of Colorado as a senior project manager. We're very excited to have all 3 of these presenters. And with that, I'm going to turn it over for them to present the topic today.
All righty, super. Well, we're all really glad to be here today. This is definitely, a topic that's important to all of us here. And, we've had the chance to work together on various projects, and so it's nice now to be able to kind of talk about them here and share that information here with everyone. For those of you that were on the October 9th Cluin talk, my first part of the presentation will be similar to that. This is kind of an expanded version of that. So don't give up in the first couple of minutes. We'll add more stuff here to it and really expand on that. And then get some other examples. So, talking here today about bulkheading considerations for mine drainage. So, a quick outline here of the presentation. Start off with just a little bit about hard rock mining. People come here with kind of different backgrounds. Just give you an idea about what kind of hard rock mining is about and why are we even here. Talk about what actually a bulkhead is. Bulkhead design is going to be a bigger topic here, bulkhead risks, you know, real and not so real. And the real important thing about how to integrate a bulkhead into your site plan. And then finally, of course, your bulk, post-bulkhead installation, you know, care and feeding. So we'll start with the geology because that is kind of the source of everything. You know, you're probably on a site with problems because there's a mine there. Why is the mine there? Well, that's because of the geology. Here's kind of a typical example of how you get metals into the ground. You've got some kind of magma source that down deep, and it's hot and moves material up. You get fractures in the rock. You then have different gases and fluids that come up through the rock, and those gases and fluids have got different metals inside them. As these metals get up into all these fractures in the ground, the pressure goes down, the temperature goes down, and these metals come out of solution, and they kind of pile up on the sides of these cracks. And when you have enough metal that collects in these cracks, you have what's called a vein, you know, something that's actually worth mining. So we'll be using some underground mining technology here today, and so I did want to bring a few things up here here to everybody. Let's take a look at a couple things. Now, everybody knows, here, everybody knows about tunnels. Okay, it's a hole in the ground that takes one side to the other. Fine. Now, we'll be using the term adit a whole bunch. Now, an adit is quite simply a tunnel that doesn't make it all the way to the other side. It's your access into the underground workings. In comparison, a shaft is a vertical opening into the underground. Now, from the other slide, remember that vein that you saw there inside the mountain? Well, that's this guy right here. When you're mining around a vein, you've got your drifts underneath, and your stopes are where you're actually mining up into the mines. So, you know, when you hear some terms here from that, here with us today, that's stuff that we're talking about. So let's talk about what happens in the area before mining, one of these mountainous areas. So we've got lovely mountains in here. We've got some faults that, in fact, you know, are veins. You know, they've got enough metal in them. And what you've got is you've got these different groundwater compartments here in the ground. So that'll be kind of our base picture. This happens here before mining. Now, people come along, they find that outcrop of that vein right there and say, this is terrific, I'm going to mine this. Alrighty, so we get a little bit here into mining. You see we've got adits coming in horizontally, we've got shafts going down, and people are mining these veins in this area, life is good. Then you get down deeper, and then you hit the water, and life stops being so good because water is really hard to deal with. It's a lot messier to work in, now you have to pump it out, that gets really expensive. What to do? Well, typically what happens is you get a couple mines that get together and they drive a drainage tunnel down below their workings, down as deep as they ever plan to go. And this thing is terrific because, as you can see, the groundwater has now drained all the way down. Your mines are dry. You can connect your mines to this drainage tunnel. So now instead of hauling your ore out, you know, expensive way up through the shaft, you can now just dump it right down the main shaft and carried out the tunnel, and life is really, really good. So all's nice in this picture, except maybe that AMD arrow over there, and got to keep that one there in mind. Because what happens is at some point, every mine plays out. You know, I always love hearing the stories about different mine sites, about, you know, the great riches that are underground, and what was the conspiracy about why was that mine shut down. And the reality is, yeah, they ran out of the good stuff. So run out the good stuff, you say, see ya, bye, and, you know, you leave the area. And, of course, no problem. All you have is, you know, water leaking out through that drainage tunnel that you built. And you know what? Now you've got a whole bunch of mine workings that are now exposing all this pyrite ore up in there to oxygen. You get water that comes through, you get sulfuric acid, this dissolves the metals and makes acid mine drainage. So now you've got in your old mine workings metal precipitate, bacterial ooze, other kind of material that builds up there. What else that you have in your old drainage tunnel is that, you know, gravity still works, so your parts of the roof fall down, create little dams, water pops up behind them, they overtop, and you get surges of water that come out. That can be a problem. And of course, your portal is probably made out of wood, and it eventually collapses, so not only do you have these surges, but they're coming through random piles of debris. Here's a beautiful picture of what it looks like behind some of those portals on a typical day. Bring the tall boots. All right. So, the post-mining evaluation. First question, of course, is, you know, you've got this old draining mine. So, first question, is the drainage a problem for water quality? If not, stop listening to this talk. If it is a problem, you've got kind of two general solutions. You can keep on draining the mountain and pretty much treat the water kind of in perpetuity. Another option in some cases would be to install underground dams, what we call bulkheads. Now these seal off the water, and they tend to improve water quality because there's kind of less oxygenation in the mine because you flooded the mine workings. There's no more oxygen direct to the pyrite, so long term it tends to improve stuff. It does allow you to do some in-situ treatment. All different kinds of ideas out there have been tried. But what we'll be talking a lot about here today in this talk is how you really need a very detailed evaluation of all the mine workings, the regional hydrogeology. You really need to go know about what's going on, what can happen. So a bulkhead would never be something to consider, boom, you know, let's decide in a week. You really need to know the site to see if it's the right thing. And you also need to have all of your preliminary information, flow data, water chemistry prior to bulkheading, so you're able to look for changes. All right, because here's what happens. If you do put in bulkheads, a key thing to determine is how high will the groundwater table go. So that's really the key parameter, because it's going to determine how many of our mine levels are going to flood, which means, and depending on how many openings there are, how many bulkheads are you going to need? What's the pressure going to be on the bulkheads? Where are you likely to find different seeps and springs? Are you going to impact any other mines, active or inactive, known, and yes, of course, the unknown ones? And the overall is feasibility. You know, in some cases, if you've got maybe two openings and the rest of the mountain is sealed, could be a real good option. If you've got 30 different mines all entering the same vein, don't bother. You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. Now, how do you figure out what the original groundwater table was? Well, a good starting point is typically to start with whatever the pre-mining groundwater table was. And that's where it's wonderful when you have access to any kind of old mining records showing when they encountered what water. Typically, the best way to know this is whenever they started driving the drainage tunnel, that's when they encountered the water, because you're not going to drive a drainage tunnel before that. So something to keep in mind there. Some of the information is available, sometimes not. Now, you start off with your pre-mine water levels, but then you have to work on that a little bit more, because you no longer have the same ground that you had before. You now have all these openings underground. The water's going to flow differently through places. Very high permeability going through a big opening. But not only flow through the actual mine workings, you also have the fault permeability. Now, with most faults, they tend to have some coarse gravelly material in the middle and clay material on the sides. That means that along the fault, it tends to be very permeable and is a good conduit for water, whereas across them, they tend to be very impermeable as water can't get through the clays. Now, of course, if you've mined out this area, you've just made a whole bunch of holes through these veins, and so all of a sudden they are very permeable even across there. So that's going to change the whole groundwater system. So here we're back to the little comic here on the whole mine site. And so the bulkheads are in place. The groundwater has gone back up to some level, kind of similar to before, but they're no longer mine compartments. You know, there's more of a general groundwater level here. Now, you also see down further below, no AMD being produced. Up top, AMD is still a bit of a problem. Okay. So let's actually talk about what a bulkhead is. A bulkhead is an engineered concrete plug that's actually designed to hold back water for a long term. It's commonly used in mines and also in hydroelectric projects. Here's a couple of different cartoon designs of the basic design concepts. There's a somewhat thinner slabs keyed into the walls at the top. The tapered plug that looks like a cork over there in the middle. And then a parallel plug that's just kind of a long rectangular plug that just runs right along right along the UN surface. So here's the more of a detailed view looking over here in profile of what a typical bulkhead may look like. So we've got the mine pool on the right, and we've got the air side here on the left. A couple things to point out, you know, you need to put these into good ground, and you need to improve the ground a bit right where you are. So first thing you do is you remove any loose or broken or weathered rock around you. Then you put up your ground support, you put your bolts and things into place. Next thing that we do, most of our blood recommend, is that you put a big grout curtain in place. You know, a grout ring, drill, you know, 20-foot foot holes and kind of a ring pattern around you to help intersect any other joints in the area and, you know, grout them up and make them less permeable. Again, we're trying to really limit the amount of water that makes its way past the bulkhead through the ground. Then you've got the rest of then you cast your concrete into place. Now, of course, before you cast your concrete in, you do have your main water line through there that you use to divert the water while you're building it, and then also, very important, a sampling pipe that you see over here up at the top that allows you to check the pressure behind the bulkhead, take water samples, and all that kind of stuff. Here's the same bulkhead just seen in here over in a couple section views. So over here on the left, we've got a grout ring pattern. Again, that's, you know, like your cutout, your big cutout key in the middle to keep water from flowing through the formation around your bulkhead. Then over here on the right, we've got our contact grouting. Now, what you have, these are shorter grout holes that are designed to grout the interface between the rock and the concrete that's placed in the bulkhead. And so, you know, these are shorter holes, just kind of go through the interface there. And typically you'll kind of combine that with like a chemical grout ring as well. Okay, what is not a bulkhead? Now, in a lot of this work, people imagine bulkheads are all kinds of different things. They talk about bulkheads failing in mines and that. So a lot of times that's not really the case. So this right here is a collapsed portal, not a bulkhead. This right here is a collapsed tunnel. Again, not a bulkhead. This is a bulkhead. This is a very nice bulkhead. It's nice, good solid concrete. You can see the remains of some of the contact grout tubes in there. You've got a lovely valve on the front. This is what a bulkhead looks like before you have any water pressure behind it. This is a bulkhead some years after you've had water behind it. You can see, you know, this bulkhead is performing perfectly fine, but, you know, there is, when you store water behind something, it does make its way through the formation, and you get a dripping and general mine scunge and that right there behind you. All right, so bulkhead placement. In general, it's going to be somewhere deep in the mine because you need to have it deep enough under good ground cover. No sense putting it near the portal, having all the water drain right out through all of your soil and stuff in the front, right? It has to be in good ground. You don't want to be in all fractured, broken up ground. Sometimes they're installed in pairs, so you can have kind of a pressure step down as you're going through the area. And, you know, you start at the lowest levels of the mines, and you move up to plug all levels that are going to be inundated. You know, and those, so that includes, you know, all areas that are, you know, hydrogeologically connected. They can be connected in different ways through workings directly, hydrogeologically for being on the same vein, or through drill holes in different mines. It's interesting what kind of exciting connections you always find in these places. So you have to understand, you know, not just the mine layouts, but also the hydrogeology and truly the extent of the impacted area. And of course, the important thing is don't stop halfway. You know, you can very effectively drain a mountain, you can effectively plug up a mountain. If you do it halfway, it's going to cause problems. So here's a project that you'll be seeing again here in Joy's talk. Here's just a kind of a quick plan view of the, you know, of the Captain Jack. You know, it's a nice layout that illustrates some considerations for my place of bulkhead. So when you look at a map like this, you're going to see, okay, all kinds of intersections of bad ground, all kinds of shears. Nope, probably not a good spot. Here we have a collapse at a bypass tunnel. Again, not a real good spot. This right here is probably a pretty good spot. You know, this is the shear that they're showing right here happens to actually be, I think, the hanging wall or foot wall of the vein. And, you know, that's something that, depending on how open it is, that you can, that you may be able to mine out in that area, you know, grab into, grout up, and be able to hold it pretty well. So gotta know where to place it. Okay, next things for bulkhead design. Let's really get into more details here. So first of all, there's the question of constructability, all right? Can you access the area? How will you access the area? Are you going to have to drive a bypass tunnel? Are you going to have to rehab and have a shaft? How do you get in there? How do you get to both sides? How do you get out after you build it? All right, what materials do you have available to build it? What are you going to need? How are you going to get it in there? Lots of concrete pumping? Are, do you have, you know, train and access? You know, how do you get this stuff in? Temporary water diversion. You know, you're dealing with the site that's draining, so there's going to be water coming at you. So how do you effectively deal with that water while constructing this beautiful bulkhead? Next, piping and valves. This is an area, you know, bulkheads tend to be designed by people that are really into mining and geology and stuff, and the rocks are very exciting. I find the rocks very exciting, but really joy I do. But there's the matter of the piping and valves. I personally don't find piping and valves very exciting at all. Fortunately, I work with people that do, and so there are things I know I need to hand over to people like that. First thing is compatible pressure ratings. You know, if you design a bulkhead for 1,000 PSI, that's terrific. If you put 150 PSI valve on it, that's going to be a lot less terrific and kind of awkward. So make sure that whatever valving you have is compatible with what you're building. And know that as soon as you go above 150 PSI, the costs for valves get really, really high. All right, what materials should be made out of? Stainless steel, anything else going to dissolve that mine water? Other big question is discharge. You know, is regular discharge planned? If your plan is to close it up and unless something goes horribly wrong, never open it up again, you may be fine with just a simple pipe and a simple valve, and there you are. If you're planning on discharging regularly, you know, perhaps because you're only going to temporarily store water, then you need to go into more detailed design about on how to open, how to keep things open. And in some cases, you know, if there's a certain flow that you have to keep, you have to design it, you know, for specific flow rates to avoid cavitation or other problems. And Joe's going to have a chance to talk about that a little bit here soon. Another pipe you're going to have in your bulkhead are testing pipes. You know, a small 1, 2, 3-inch diameter pipe that you can use to take water samples from and test the water pressure behind your bulkhead. Next thing, bulkhead design is to consider all the different failure modes, and then, you know, how do you effectively design for those with a good factor of safety. Let's start with hydraulic jacking. Now, hydraulic jacking is where the water pressure opens up the joints in the rock. Now, it may be that, the rock has some fractures and things in it, but, you know, they're pretty closed. Water doesn't really get through. As water pressure builds up, after a certain point, those joints open up, and all of a sudden, instead of it being a tiny hairline joint, it suddenly opened, maybe a couple of millimeters, and all of a sudden it lets a lot of water through. So that's what they're trying to avoid. Now, how do you avoid hydraulic jacking? You have to locate your tunnel, your bulkhead, under high enough cover, so you have enough weight of rock up above you. You have to understand the ground stresses and just know what are the pressures inside the ground. A lot of times you can do that with packer testing. That's what the guys over here in the photo are doing, where you drill a borehole and you pressurize a certain section of that and you measure how much water it takes under certain pressures. And essentially, once you hit that critical point, all of a sudden your flow rates really, really go up. So that's an important thing to know. Again, you can, if you design a bulkhead for 1,000 PSI, but at 200 PSI, the rock opens up around it, well, that's not really going to work for you, right? All right, next failure mode, perimeter shear failure along the tunnel. This would be the bulkhead zipping right along the rock interface. Probably not realistic, easy to get against, but kind of exciting to think about, really. So how do you avoid having your beautiful bulkhead go skittering down the tunnel? Well, you would have nice rough walls. The cork shape is always a nice thing to have, or keying it in, as we saw in those couple cartoon samples in there. Rock bolts in the rock that tie into, you know, your steel reinforcing, and of course grouting up that interface between the rock and the bulkhead. Another exciting way to fail a bulkhead is structural failure. That's when the actual bulkhead fails through the concrete, either by bending or shearing and breaking the actual concrete apart. Now, you see, you fix this by making your bulkhead long enough, using the proper size reinforcing steel, using the right kind of quality of concrete. Where this becomes more of an issue are in places that are more seismically active, because what you can get a water hammer effect, just like you would in a pipe. You know, if you've got this, a certain kind of earthquake conditions, and so that's the biggest load that you'd be likely to get on a structure. And so that's, especially if you live out in California, that's certainly a design consideration to have. All right, another failure mode would be concrete degradation. You know, it is acidic mine water, and concrete, well, is made out of calcium carbonate, and so the acidity can chemically break down the concrete and turn it into a gray mush. So how do you deal with that? Well, you add some sacrificial thickness. You know, you figure the first little bit of your bulkhead is probably the concrete is going to degrade. No problem. Make it longer. All right, that's easy. Another thing is to reduce the permeability. You know, some of it is just done with a mixed design with enough sand and cement paste. In some cases, people have used, you know, some other admixtures that reduce the permeability within the concrete. Those are all some good options. You want to use a type 2/5 cement. That's a cement that is highly sulfide resistant. And also substituting some of your cement for fly ash, just because that doesn't react with acidic water at all. And then another nice thing to do, at least short-term effect, is place some lime upstream so that while your concrete is curing, you're able to, you know, bring the pH up quite a bit there. Okay, so seepage and piping. So seepage and piping is excessive seepage past the plug. And that's really your most likely mode of failure. And by failure, we may mean, gosh, it's not holding back the water as nice as we'd like. Or the worst case would be an actual piping failure where you have water that starts flowing through an opening and it takes a little bit of material out. Then more water starts flowing out. It picks up bigger chunks of material, which lets more water flow out, which picks up bigger chunks of material, which lets more water flow, which picks up more chunks of material. You see where we're going, and all of a sudden, you know, you have an opening that suddenly becomes very large. You get an uncontrolled flow of water flowing past it, and life stinks. So that is an important thing to design against. Now, how do you do that? Well, back to the geology. If I got to do good geologic mapping, find those joints and shears around the bulkhead, places that would likely give you that first run around the bulkhead. That grout ring that you guys saw, you know, trying to really make the whole formation less permeable, important thing to put in there. The grout between the contact and, you know, up the tunnel and the bulkhead. Another thing is just making the plug long enough. You know, if you guys think to your flow nets that you got to draw in your geotech classes, you know, the longer your structure is, the longer the pressure on the upstream side has to dissipate to the zero pressure on the other side. So that's another key point in there, you know, big, nice long structure. And, of course, post-installation monitoring. You know, you may have done a great job in designing a long bulkhead, and you've mapped all the joints, and you grout it up, and life is good. But, you know, there's always unknown things. There's going to be joints that you didn't see before that suddenly appear. Joints that you did not think were connected to the mine pool actually are. And so it's pretty common to have to do some additional grouting, you know, after a bulkhead installation, maybe along a thicker joint or maybe around the bulkhead again, or even extended. So in the picture over here on the right, you guys can see the grout packers from a grout ring. And then here on this slide, this right here, along with beautiful formwork made by miners, you can see over here these bigger tubes here, you know, are your Are your contact grout tubes, you know, that go back through, you know, 5, 6, or 8 feet or so through that the concrete and rock interface. And then we've also got some tubes, some valves up in here that go to the, in this case, to a chemical grouting ring. Okay, bulkhead mitts. Now this is fun. So if everybody here on this call, what I would really appreciate, I think what all of us would be very amused by, is for your questions here at the end, if you could list some of your bulkhead myths that you've heard, because those are always a lot of fun to talk about, and we'll be like the bulkhead mythbusters here for the last part of the talk. So that'll be cool. So first myth, bulkheads are the right solution for every mine site. Well, no. If the ground is too permeable, or there's too many openings, not a good choice. Next myth, bulkheads will eliminate all mine water drainage. No. They reduce the flows by a lot, you know, 90%, maybe more, you know. If you've got a 1,000 GPM of water coming out of your tunnel, you put in a bulkhead, you can probably knock it down to 50, 100 GPM or so, but it is not going to be perfectly dry. The next myth is particularly popular and sometimes, unfortunately, just necessity given funding and ownership and so on. Bulkheads can be installed and forgotten. They're maintenance-free. Well, they do need regular inspection and monitoring. Can it always be done? Realistically, not necessarily, but that can turn them into a problem later on. Another fun one here is bulkheads only affect individual mines. You know, and that's, of course, a big problem because, you know, if I own one mine in the area, my solution now to close my mine is to bulkhead it up. I'm okay with paying for bulkheads in my own mine. I'm not okay with paying for bulkheads into the mine that cheapskate next door who actually stole a bunch of my ore anyway, and forget that, right? So, but realistically, bulkheads have to be part of a holistic solution. You know, it needs, you know, for the whole mine site, the whole mine area, the whole whatever mines are connected. You know, you have to deal with that whole thing, because all these other mines, they can be connected directly or just through the natural fractures. I mean, they're all mining the same vein, right? All right, last myth here to talk about are that bulkheads always improve water quality. So the answer is typically yes. Most cases, you know, since flooded mine workings reduce the amount of oxygen available for pyrite reactions, you know, you can, it tends to improve the water quality. But, as we'll find out, water quality can also decrease as the salts immobilize, particularly earlier in workings, or if bulkheads are used for temporary storage, that could be a significant problem. Alrighty, bulkhead risks, real and imagined. Let's go to the imagined ones first, because they're really a lot more fun. So, you put in a bulkhead, the water is going to pile up behind it until it squirts at the very top of the peak. Well, no, the water's going to go back to something like the groundwater level it was at before, you know, so there we are with that. Another fun one is that the bulkhead concrete shoots out explosively like a cannon out the attic. That would be very exciting. That would be very, very neat. Not realistic. But kind of fun to think about, I guess. All right, let's talk about the real risks that you get. Well, leakage past the bulkhead, it requires some additional grouting, or in some cases, a second bulkhead. Water flows out of other mine workings, the known and the unknown ones. You know, the mines didn't think were connected. Oh, flow suddenly comes in. Or you may think all's well, and all of a sudden you see orange water coming out from little copse of trees, or perhaps from what looked like simply a pile of avalanche debris. Uh-oh. Seeps develop in the surrounding area. Sure, the water is pressured up inside the mouth. It's going to seep out somewhere. Are the seeps a problem or not? Be determined. Here's another one. Water seeping past the bulkhead still requires some form of treatment. What a bummer. That could be. Now, the good thing is, you know, like if we go back to the example of about 1,000 GPM of water flowing out, 1,000 GPM, you're looking at an active water treatment plant. If you knock that down to 50 GPM, now you're suddenly in the realm of, you know, some potential more passive treatment, which is, of course, a lot cheaper and a lot easier to work with. A real risk in that piping failure around the bulkhead. You know, if the water makes its way around it, That can be a problem. And, of course, the liability for flooding adjacent mines. All right. Second last section here of the talk is how to integrate a bulkhead into the site plan. You have to remember that bulkheads really are just one component of the site solution. You know, they're using in conjunction with, you know, other monitoring and sampling on the site. Different flumes, different flows come out of different places, stream gauges, ponds, passive treatment from this and from other mines, potentially in-situ treatment, if that's what you're looking at, potentially still with treatment plants, if that's needed. And bulkheads can be used really in different ways in different mine sites as you integrate them in. And there's a great quote from a talk that I was at recently, and I can't remember the author, but he said, this speaker said, if it were free and available on Monday, what would you do with it? And so that's really a big question to ask yourself with this bulkhead. If it were free and available on Monday, what would you do with this bulkhead? So that's really something to keep in mind. Let's see how we can use the bulkheads in kind of different ways. It can work as a flow control structure. Now, flow control structure is something where you're not trying to keep all the water inside the mountain. Perhaps you're keeping the mountain drained, and maybe whatever treatment system that you have can deal just fine with normal flows, but you're into problems to where you have surges as the mine burps and sends slug material out. So by putting a flow control structure, essentially, you know, a thin bulkhead or an over-glorified, steel door, you can then adjust the flows to whatever your treatment system can handle. So that's a nice thing. These do require regular cleaning and maintenance. Temporary storage. You know, you may have a mine site where the ground is just so broken up that if you store the water too long, it starts leaking out and it's just not usable. But, again, you're thinking about your whole mine site. And maybe you're treating the water and maybe only a very limited storage for that water on the site. So an option could be that you store water underground for part of the season while you treat other surface water in the critical areas. And then if the water level gets high enough inside the mountain and starts to dribble out, then you draw down the water and you treat that. And this is, so you're actually using your underground storage almost like a second reservoir. Or perhaps, you know, if there's some kind of in-situ treatment that you're able to do, that you treat it inside the mountain and then release it after the water is clean, that could be another option. Another option then, of course, is the permanent seal. It returns the groundwater to pre-mining conditions, sort of. You treat the seeps past, you know, with kind of passive means. You just have to monitor the bulkhead regularly. The condition of the bulkhead, the head behind it, how's the rest of the ground behaving. And perhaps you combine that with some in-situ treatment. Last section here on the post-bulkhead installation. So, keeping permanent access to the bulkhead for monitoring. You need to be looking for any seepage past the bulkhead, see if it's becoming a problem. You need to look and know if the water level is behind the bulkhead. You know, you designed your bulkhead for some water level. You know, if you designed your bulkhead for 1,000 PSI, you have 800 behind it, that's just fine. You designed it for 1,000 PSI, you have 1,200 behind it, that's less fine. And you may need to put in a second bulkhead or extend the one that you have. You want to develop, you know, and execute a proper filling and monitoring plan for when you decide to close your bulkhead. Just like with the dam, closing it up and just walking away is not a good plan. You need to have a good baseline of all the flows coming out of different areas. You need to monitor how fast the bulkhead is coming up. In many cases, you'll want to take the bulkhead pressure up to maybe a certain level. And then wait, see if it becomes a problem. Then maybe take it up 50 feet, for example, check. Maybe take it up another 100 feet. Give it a month or something to check. Maybe bring it up a little bit further. So those are the things you need to look at. And that's all going to vary by your mine's site as to how often you might do that. You have to look for changes in water chemistry. How does your baseline change with a bulkhead coming in there? What's happening with surrounding mines? What's happening to surrounding seeps, increasing, decreasing? What's happening to streams in the area? You know, you're going to have some stored water leaking back to the streams. Problem, not a problem, see. There's the actual bulkhead inspection and evaluation. You know, you need to take a look at, you know, the condition of the actual concrete face. the condition of the valves and the pipes and the stuff that's in there, the condition of any instruments that you may have behind there. You're again looking for those concentrated flows around a bulkhead to see if that's sort of becoming a problem. Does it need additional grouting or what? You're looking for any kind of concentrated flows, even downstream of the bulkhead. Again, there may be one of those joints that you didn't think was connected to the mine pool, but uh-oh, guess it is. And, it happens. And then, of course, you need to check the condition of the ground support, to keep your access open to that bulkhead. You may need to go in on a regular basis, to clean out the drainage ditch. You may need to install, new bolts or new support. Because what else could happen? Can you find the valve in this picture? This took me a bit of time here. And for those of you that are especially working on some small screens, let's scooch the arrow right in over here. Yep, there we are. There's the valve wheel. Now, of course, I'm standing at this bulkhead with a new pressure gauge in my pocket because my plan was to go in, and I figured the old pressure gauge probably was no good. I was going to unscrew it, screw on a new one, and I was going to find what the pressure was behind this bulkhead. That didn't happen on this trip. This required a little bit more work. Right here, now we have a lovely, hot-tapped bypass valve on here with a wonderful pressure gauge. And we've left the place a little nicer than we found it. So, I have some concluding thoughts here. So, due to the cost of, indefinite treatment, bulkheads should at least be considered, on draining underground mine projects. Are they always the right solution? No, but should at least be considered. The regional and local geology and hydrogeology are key, for evaluating if and where to install bulkheads. You really have to, once you know the general area, you have to then, during the bulkhead design, really take a close look at the local area and areas of potential seepage. If the bulkhead remains open, do keep in mind that even if you put in a bulkhead and it ends up not being something that you necessarily want to use to pressurize up, they can still serve, as regulate flow and limit the damage from burps and stuff there. Whatever seepage you get past the bulkhead or coming out of other seeps in the area may still be a big improvement over groundwater quality. So just, the fact you're not able to totally seal something off does not mean that it was not effective. And, of course, bulkheads can be combined with, in-situ treatment or just dealing with other treatment plants. A few more concluding thoughts. Bulkheads may or may not be the right solution for your site. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all. You should install them only after very significant study and design. Adjacent mines may be affected and would probably end up being a problem for you. And yes, monitoring maintenance are needed after installation as much as it is totally possible. And so with that, I'd like to open it up to, I think, just a couple questions here from the audience here on this before we move on to our other speakers.
Wonderful. Thank you, Christoph. We did get a number of questions coming in as you were speaking. I want to remind our participants that they can continue to submit their questions using the Q&A pod. But while we're waiting for more questions, let's ask a few that have come in. We have one person who wants to know if you could talk about the range of flow rates you have addressed with bulkheads.
I mean, actually, I'd say the highest flows that I've been aware of on design was about 20, maybe 2,500, 2,000 to begin with. And then another one I was asked to look at, they had a flow rate of about 1.5 GPM, which did lead me to the big question of, do you really want this? And also the answer was, no, not really, but isn't there. Jeff or Joy?
I mean, considering these are used on dam projects, I mean, a lot of times there you have significant heads and flow rate. So I think it can run across the entire spectrum in terms of flow rate.
Okay. Another question. This participant makes a statement about criteria to consider to decide how long to monitor a bulkhead to arrive at a stable pool. or stable pool conditions. While site-specific, what are some of the factors you would consider in trying to arrive at that stable pool?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Jeff, did you want to address that?
This is Jeff Graves. I'll show in a couple of the case studies coming up pretty good slides that establish, you know, how quickly a bulkhead reached the relatively steady state condition. And so I think it'll be pretty obvious, and, you know, based on that, I mean, it certainly is site-specific in terms of how long it takes, but in the at least two examples I'm going to show and the other sites I'm aware of, it's typically established a steady state condition within actually a couple months to a year. And so once you've usually gone through a full hydrologic cycle, you get a pretty good idea as to what that final bulkhead or mine pool elevation is going to be as a result of the bulkhead.
Okay, great. Well, with that, I think it might be good to move on to some of the site examples and to the next presentation at this point, and while letting our participants send in more questions as you're talking.
Okay, so this is Jeff Graves, and I'm going to be covering a couple of bulkhead case studies. And actually, we have quite a few bulkheads that the state has been involved in here in Colorado, and I just chose two of the sites here. The first site that we're going to be kind of talking about is the Dinero Tunnel Bulkhead, and it's located in Lake County, Colorado. This one was installed in 2009, so we've got a pretty good post bulkhead data set to kind of go over. Then I'll also be talking about a number of bulkheads that were installed at the Pennsylvania mine in Summit County. There were actually three bulkheads constructed at that site, and we'll kind of cover a little bit regarding the reasoning behind having three different bulkheads and kind of the site-specific conditions. Okay, so we'll start off with the Dinero Tunnel, and you've got some obviously lovely and attractive AMD at this mine site. Let's see.
Get the... Scroll to the right. There.
Sorry, just trying to find the pointer here. So there we go. Okay. So you can see the large iron discharge. The portal's located right about there, and then you've got some waste rock piles sitting in the wetland just below the site. And then the photo on the right is kind of a picture just outside the mine portal, and you can see obviously significant precipitation of iron hydroxides and all kinds of bacterial ooze, as Christoph discussed earlier. So, lovely photo. So I'll give you a little bit information regarding the setting. The Dinero Tunnel is located in the Sugarloaf Mining District, and that area is kind of this whole area right in here. It's located just kind of south of Turquoise Lake outside of Leadville. Most of the mining took place here in the late 1880s to the kind of early 1900s. They produced silver, gold, lead, zinc, pretty typical for most of the hard rock mining districts here in Colorado. The mining was located in a large granitic intrusion that had a number of small, narrow veins that were in place based on some tertiary intrusions into that area. And so you've got these fractures, and the majority of the ore deposition was long fractures kind of through that area in that granitic intrusion. And so the Dinero area, based on some of the water sampling that was done, accounts for about 75% of the manganese and zinc loading to the overall kind of lake fork, which is this creek right here, Lake Fork Creek, which feeds into eventually the Arkansas River over here. But kind of this area right in here accounted for the majority of the loading, metals loading, kind of into the lower Lake Fork Creek down there. As you can kind of see on here, here's a close-up over in here of kind of the site, the boxed area over there. Couple of the Dinero Tunnel discharged onto those waste rock piles and then kind of right into Sugarloaf Gulch and then into that lower wetland. and then eventually picked up loading from the other drainages around there in those drainage tunnels. And on the next slide, you can kind of see a little more defined photo of where those drainage tunnels were. And so this is part of what Christoph discussed in terms of getting a good sense of what the overall geology and kind of mine working system is within the area to get a better understanding of how potential bulkheading might impact other areas. And within the Sugarloaf Mining District, you've got a number of drainage tunnels. The majority of those drainage tunnels were driven kind of to the northwest to mine ore bodies that were back up in this area back in here. And so originally those discoveries were mined through shafts back in here, like Christoph kind of discussed, and then eventually they encountered the water table and needed to drain that area. Probably the biggest drainage tunnel in the area is the Dinero Tunnel down here. There's a couple others in the area, but the Dinero tended to drain the majority of this kind of ore body back in here. So there's a lot going on, needless to say. So with any investigation that might result in putting in a bulkhead, there's pretty significant baseline water quality sampling that needs to occur in the area. And this is not only to establish what the existing loads are and whether or not even looking at a bulkhead at one of the tunnels would deal with the majority of the problem, but it's also just to establish the baseline to understand what happens after you install that bulkhead. So you get some kind of sense as to how is it actually impacting the groundwater system within the region. And so with the Dinero Tunnel, there was a pretty significant effort made to establish a number of water quality sampling locations. Some of these are historic springs within the area. Some of them are mine tunnels or drainage tunnels. And then some of these are just your superficial creeks and runoff areas. So that all helps to kind of establish that baseline. To either build the case that the bulkhead's working or not working or successful or marginally successful. So we'll do a little bit of site-specific stuff here. So tunnel conditions, as you can see in the photo in the lower left, you kind of see the iron hydroxide mark down here. And so that's indicative of the fact that elevations within that tunnel or that mine pool vary quite a bit and probably ended up with some kind of blowout in the past where you had water backed up to that elevation and then suddenly released. So there's historic evidence of kind of water being impounded and released. We did a tunnel investigation in 2005, which required quite a bit of underground rehab. And that's a big part of doing any of these tunnel investigations and kind of a pretty significant cost is establishing safe enough working conditions to gather the data needed to be able to decide if a bulkhead's even an option. And so we did a good bit of underground rehab to access areas of the tunnel to kind of get a better sense of what that underground plumbing was. You can see kind of over on the right slide, doing that underground investigation usually results in a pretty big mess when you're walking around inside there and mucking around. You get quite a bit of release of iron hydroxides. Thankfully, at this site, we had a number of ponds downstream that we were able to address that iron hydroxide in when we were inside mucking around. But it can be pretty challenging just to do the investigation component of any of these sites. And sometimes actually the underground rehab becomes more expensive than the actual bulkhead installation. So at this site, based on the initial work that we did to do investigations, we decided that this might be a great site for a bulkhead. So based on a number of the criteria that kind of Christoph talked about in terms of needing a significant overburden to reduce the potential for hydrojacking or hydrofracking, we selected a bulkhead location that was about 1,250 feet from the portal. So here's the narrow portal over here. We did exploration all the way back to where we were prevented from exploring further based on a cave-in. And then based on the geology and the fractures within that area and the required head that we would, or the required overburden that we would need, so that's kind of this distance right here based on the potential pressure, we selected a spot at about 1,250 feet from the portal. That design head that we have there of 680 feet was really based on this De Niro shaft over here, which would be the next discharge location. So typically that design had the function of, if you were to back water up, where would water just discharge naturally at the next elevation? And that De Niro shaft would kind of be our pressure relief valve if we were to exceed that design pressure. And so that De Niro shaft guided the actual 680 feet of design head as part of that bulkhead placement. And so we decided on a 15-foot thick reinforced concrete parallel plug. As Christoph mentioned, there's a couple of different methodologies for bulkhead design. Based on the design head, the rock conditions at the site, the amount of roughness along the sides of that adit, we decided that a parallel plug would be sufficient if it was 15 feet thick to resist any of the thrust created by that 680 feet of head. So I kind of covered a little bit of this, but you know, one of the big questions is why choose a bulkhead at this site? And really, one of the first reasons for choosing a bulkhead is cost-effective flow control. Bulkheads really allow you to prevent those burps or those sudden surges that result in downstream water quality impacts. So it's very cost-effective at doing that. At this site, we knew we did not have the funding, nor really the desire to put in a permanent water treatment plant at this spot. And so bulkheads do provide an alternative to water treatment. It's one way to try and reduce loading without having to put in a water treatment plant. At this site, we knew we had pretty limited mine working connectivity. So we knew that if we backed up water, at least we didn't have a lot of other mine workings that were potentially connected to this mine. And then the crosscut tunnel scenario is something just to think about with respect to where you place that bulkhead and what the surrounding geology looks like. As Christoph mentioned, one of the terms in mining is a drift, and usually those drifts are horizontal workings that are driven on structure. And a crosscut is a tunnel that's driven oftentimes perpendicular or at least oblique to the dominant structural pattern within the rock. And so typically, if you've got a crosscut, putting a bulkhead in that location is good because most of your fractures are running perpendicular, or at least your dominant fractures are running perpendicular to the actual mine workings. And then it also provides an opportunity to reduce oxygen interaction with those sulfides. And so here's just some photos of general bulkhead construction. This is actually the De Niro bulkhead construction photos. So you can kind of see the upper left is the initial construction, and this is construction of the cofferdam. When you're constructing that bulkhead, you've got to deal with the water that's still going through that location. You don't shut the water off while you're working to put the bulkhead in. So you've got to capture the water, upgrade it, and get it through your bulkhead location so you can construct your formwork and pour your concrete. The other photos through here are just general form construction, kind of building the inner and outer forms that you're going to be pumping your concrete into. You can see this is kind of the completed inside face of the waterside bulkhead, or actually that's the airside bulkhead, because you can see up here in the upper portion the grout tubes that Christoph had spoken about for your contact grouting. So that's the inside face of the air side of that bulkhead. And then you can see down here what's required in terms of floor cleanout. And typically through that mining process, the actual driving of that drift results in a pretty irregular floor that has to be completely cleaned out. And you may have a floor that has 2 to 3 feet of backfilled material that then the mine track was laid on. And so it does require a significant amount of cleaning to actually get good contact with solid rock all the way around that bulkhead. And so here's a picture where the concrete's being pumped into the mine, you know, the pipes down here, and then here's the final product. Christoph also mentioned the pressure gauge, and so this had not only the discharge line, but then we also had a separate 3/4 inch line to monitor pressure and to conduct sampling. And so as somebody asked earlier a question regarding kind of mine pool elevation and when you reach that steady state condition, so this is pressure monitoring at the De Niro Tunnel mine pool, so at the bulkhead face, over the course of about the last 10 years. And as you can see, We achieved relatively steady state conditions pretty quickly. It's about a year, roughly a year to get to steady state conditions up in here. And then it tends to fluctuate based on the hydrograph. But we kind of have peak elevations, and then we'll have some troughs through here, and it remains relatively consistent along that kind of time period in terms of what the actual head is. And this is head on the side, not pressure. So it's about 400 feet ahead is what we typically run at that site. So a little bit of post-bulkhead data, and this shows some interesting things. One thing I'll note on here is we did sampling at the site, or USGS did sampling kind of for the larger group at the site. Initially in June of 2006 was kind of our baseline data, and then they sampled the next 3 years. And the three sites that are shown on here, one is the Dinero Tunnel discharge. We have a downstream location here, and then LF580 is the farthest downstream location, which we kind of, I don't want to call it a compliance point, but that's really where we're trying to establish better water quality. And so as you can see on here, these are each one of those sampling locations, and you'll see discharge, pH, total zinc concentration, and then total zinc load. And some encouraging things we saw, we definitely had at the Dinero Tunnel a reduction, which is, you know, not surprising, consider we pretty much shut off the flow or reduced the flow significantly. And then we also saw some downstream improvements in both pH. So we had pre-pH condition in 3.7, and we saw nearly a full unit of pH increase downstream. So that's pretty significant. We also saw zinc loads decrease downstream. There were some anomalies that occurred in 2011, and that was a pretty big snow year. And so we think that we also had some downstream influence from other sites within the watershed that were more surface related. But there could have been a component of mine pool that impacted water quality during that time too. But as you can see, it does show improvement. One thing that I don't have on here, and I believe USGS is going to be publishing a paper here in the next year or so that discusses some long-term monitoring they've done. They did some additional sampling at the site between 2015 and 2018 that kind of confuses the picture a little bit. We don't see quite the improvement over the long term that we saw initially. So you'll just have to wait for that data to come out. One of the impacts we did see was as that water table rose within the region based on having the tunnel plugged, we saw an increase of discharge at one of the adjacent mine sites. So this is something that Christoph kind of mentioned that can happen. Here's the Nelson Tunnel right over here. Here's the Dinero Tunnel. This whole area back here is now flooded, you know, up to 400 feet above where it was prior to the bulkhead. And we started seeing significant increase in discharge at the Nelson Tunnel. So the upper left photo is pre-bulkhead. And then you can see the bottom left photo is about 4 years following bulkhead installation. Pretty significant change in discharge at the Nelson Tunnel location. And so we definitely saw what we think is an impact as a result of having a regionally raised water table. And what we think is what's gone on, as you can see, I've kind of highlighted here in red, there's a large geologic structure that runs kind of this direction from the northwest to the southeast, and the Dinero Tunnel actually accesses, and the majority of the mine workings are on that geologic structure back here. Our hypothesis is that regional water table raised and then now is kind of utilizing that fault zone as a conduit that Christoph kind of mentioned they can function as and carrying water down to the Nelson Tunnel where it eventually discharges. So it is an impact that we think is a result of having that mine pool raised significantly. So here's some data that kind of bears that connection out. It's a little bit of a complicated slide, but these are other sampling locations. And so Little Sugarloaf Gulch, I'll go back one slide, is kind of this zone right here. So this is Little Sugarloaf Gulch. Dinero Tunnel did not discharge into it. This is an adjacent surface gulch. And what you'll see, Little Sugarloaf Gulch, these are some sampling locations in there. You'll see pre-bulkhead, obviously the zinc concentration really high. All the adjacent discharge locations, zinc concentration's pretty low. What we saw following bulkhead installation and valve closure in 2009 was what appears to be an increase in adjacent discharge locations. So the Nelson Tunnel is here in these upside down purple triangles. You can see a general trend in the upward direction for zinc concentration. And then also in Sugarloaf Gulch, you're seeing the same kind of a trend on the star there. And so we do see what appears to be an interaction between that mine pool and adjacent surface water discharge and other mine workings. But so far, at least in the data that we have available at this point, there is still a downstream improvement in load, but it's not as great as we were hoping for. So a little bit of a summary of Dinero bulkhead results. I always like to keep in mind what the purpose of that bulkhead was in terms of evaluating its success or failure. And one of the purposes was to reduce or eliminate blowout and surge events. And this bulkhead successfully has done that. We did reduce discharge at the portal and then also reduce downstream loading of most metals. It is a little bit of a mixed picture, and I think some of the new data that USGS is publishing may not bear that out completely, but we certainly did not decrease water quality downstream. We're just not seeing as much of an decrease in water quality that we were hoping for, or an increase in water quality that we were hoping for. We did see an increased flow at the Nelson Tunnel, which wasn't unexpected. But we were hoping that it wouldn't have had as significant of an impact. And then we also saw increased loading in Sugarloaf Gulch, which at this point hasn't offset the downstream improvements, but it is something that we're keeping an eye on. And so as I mentioned, kind of that long-term impact is still unknown. And that's the big thing with bulkheads is a lot of times it takes a long time to understand the full impacts to that groundwater system surrounding the bulkhead. So the next one we'll touch on is the Pennsylvania mine. You can see some other lovely photos of AMD discharge across mine waste piles. We installed a flume pre-investigation to get an understanding of what flow rates were at the site. In the photo on the right, you can see where the discharge from the portal actually meets the cleaner receiving stream, and then you've got precipitation of iron hydroxide and aluminum hydroxide downstream. So setting here, very similar to the Dinero site, you've got kind of a large, I think I'll show in the next slide what the geology is, but you've got a lot of mine sites around here, and we've established a lot of mining-related water or monitoring locations. But it's located in the upper reaches of Peru Creek, which is just outside of Keystone. Here's the Keystone ski area over here. And based on the data that we collected, the Pennsylvania mine is the single largest man-made metals contributor to the Snake River at about 40,000 pounds of zinc per year, so a huge loader. And that's borne out down here in the lower kind of tables here. This is looking at zinc load from upstream above the Pennsylvania mine to downstream, and you can see a significant increase in pretty much all the metals concentrations above and below the Pennsylvania mine. So established pretty well that this is the bad actor within the watershed. So as with kind of like the Dinero Tunnel, you've got a situation where you've got a large geologic stock here, or an in-place stock called the Montezuma Stock, and then you've got mineralization along the margins. You've also got a shear zone over here that did have significant mineralization too. So a lot of hydrothermal alteration kind of in the surrounding rock, which does influence how well we can establish the success of that bulkhead, because there's a lot of natural loading going on within this watershed. So kind of the history of the mine site, the photo on the left is here's the cross-section of what the mine looks like, and then here's a kind of plan view looking down at it here. So it was originally discovered in 1879. It was mined actually up until about the 1950s for both gold and silver. They had five or six main levels, A through F, and then some sub-levels in between, and a lot of stoping between those levels, so pretty open in the upper workings. And it was a decent producer, mostly silver, not a huge producer. So not one of the biggest mine sites, but since it was driven as a drainage tunnel, pretty significant impact to the local watershed. One of the challenges we had in evaluating the site is initially all the portals into those mine workings were actually collapsed. And so we did some interesting investigative techniques to establish kind of the pipe, the underground flow system, and how things were connected based on doing some tracer studies and isotope analysis. So here's kind of a site picture. We're sitting at about 11,000 feet here, so pretty high up in the watershed. This is a trace of the vein system where it's exposed on surface, and you can see kind of the two main levels, the F levels, the drainage tunnel, and then you've got another main entry level, the C level up here, which is about 270 feet above the F level. And then here's Peru Creek down here, and that's where that earlier photo was where the discharge intercepts. You can also see a number of what are collapsed stopes here up on the surface, where mining actually went all the way to the surface and is probably collecting surface runoff and snow melt and channeling it into those mine workings. So as I mentioned, the portals were collapsed, and so we did have to do a significant amount of portal and underground rehab at this site. So we excavated out the portal, installed a good bit of ground support, and then put in a large 12-foot diameter culvert to allow access into those workings. Here's kind of two before and after pictures down here on the bottom of the amount of rehab that was done underground just to provide safe access. So this is kind of at the main junction with the vein, before with the timber and all the iron hydroxide, and then you can see kind of what that looked like after we had done rehab. So pretty significant effort, as I mentioned before, is rehab, and pretty expensive. So we did a good bit of underground characterization to establish what's going on with the plumbing system underground. Obviously these are not quantitative, but we have pretty good water in certain locations, and we had very bad water in other locations. And I won't get into too much of the detail in terms of why that's going on, but the majority of it is this is the main fault structure here where most of the mineralization occurred, and the water that moves down that fault structure through the upper workings is pretty bad because it's been moving through a good bit of sulfide ore. This is a crosscut that was driven all the way back to try and intercept other veins, so they didn't really have nearly the same kind of intersect with an ore body on this section through here. But we kind of had two zones where we had water coming into the site. This is a crosscut tunnel, as I mentioned, so could be conducive to having a bulkhead just based on the natural trend of the geologic structures in that area. And so we did a good bit of water sampling and kind of see what the inside of that mine workings looked like after we'd gotten it cleaned out. So why choose a bulkhead at the site? Really, it's a lot of the same reasons that we chose the bulkhead at the Dinero site, one of the biggest being cost-effective flow control. At this site, we have had pretty significant surge slash blowout events in the past. Typical flow at the sites up to about a maximum of 150 GPM at the peak of the hydrograph, but there were certain occasions following rainfall where we had a peak flow of over 1.5 CFS. And so we wanted at least at a minimum to be able to control flow. And then also a lot of the things I mentioned before, same kind of things, alternative to water treatment. We were not going to build a water treatment plant here. And a pretty simple mine in terms of connectivity. So we did build two bulkheads at this site. One back along the crosscut here because I showed that we had pretty significant water inflow back here. And then we also built an outer bulkhead to capture the water that was flowing down that drift through here. One of the challenges we have is we don't have a lot of rock cover here because we're not very far back in the tunnel. This outer bulkhead is only about 275 feet from the portal, and we only have a little over 100 feet of cover at that location, which is really why we tried to step the pressure down with two bulkheads at this site. So we built the first bulkhead up here in 2014. Impounded water and eventually grouted off all the connections within that bulkhead, and then poured the second bulkhead downstream as kind of the step down to capture the remaining flow and then also step that pressure down. And so you can kind of see some of the basics with respect to design on those bulkheads. Okay, just a couple pictures of bulkhead construction. I won't spend too much time on these. You can just kind of look through general process, it's pretty much the same at each one of the sites. Cleaning out the floor, establishing your airside and waterside formwork and then putting in your grout pipes and all the inner workings of your bulkhead. And then here's construction of bulkhead 2, very similar situation. Like I mentioned, it's always a challenge to get that floor cleaned out, and that's kind of the one of the critical points is getting the floor completely clean so you have good contact with your wall rock. Okay, so do a quick kind of here on what our pressures are on the bulkhead. So this time period, and at this site we actually installed pressure transducers with data loggers on the backside of the bulkhead so that we could have real-time pressure all year long and have that recorded. And so it records pressure twice daily on both of these bulkheads. And we also established a flume out front that saves flow rate at about the same time as the bulkheads monitor pressure. And so this is from about 2014 all the way to 2018, so over the last 4 years. You can see steady state at the inner bulkhead actually took 2 seasons to establish. First season, it made it up to this pressure and then dropped down over the summer, and then we established what appears to be a steady state pressure because it pretty much meets the peaks on all these. And you see a very similar trend in terms of dewatering from behind the bulkhead over the course of the year. And then we had a similar situation on the inner bulkhead where it established, or the outer bulkhead where it established pressure actually the first year, and then we've got pretty steady state pressure. So a lot of gaps in here, and we've had some issues keeping the batteries powered at that elevation considering the temperatures over the winter and the fact that we can't access the site out of, I don't know, 6 months out of the year. But we've got pretty good data. You definitely see a flow, increase in flow rate at the portal based on an increase in pressure behind those bulkheads. But this flow rate right here actually reflects a significant reduction over what we had prior. So it's even the peaks here are about a third of what they would have been otherwise, and they're very short-lasting, so they're very temporal. But we also suspect that that steady state is a function of bedrock colluvial contact, and we're actually getting discharge from the mine pool into that contact and then down through the colluvium, so never actually surfaces. Bulkhead results. So these are bulkhead results for pH and zinc. Here in the red, you'll see is pre-bulkhead data. This is looking from upstream near the Pennsylvania mine downstream to the Snake River, which is about 6,000 meters downstream. You can see what looks like a pretty good trend. We've got very low pH prior to the bulkhead, and then each of the subsequent years, we actually have an increase in bulkhead directly downstream. We tend to lose that as we have other sections or other streams that discharge into the Peru Creek that actually have a pretty significant background load, non-related to mining, so it's just the natural geology. So we're not seeing as significant of an improvement all the way downstream as we would hope, but definitely as a result of the bulkhead, we see improvement within the local watershed. Same situation for zinc. This was zinc pre-bulkhead. Here's zinc following bulkhead closure, and we do see a reduction, not necessarily as big as we would like. The interesting thing here is we do see a pretty significant increase over in this area, and this is far enough downstream that we don't think it's connected to the mine pool. This is more a function of the local geology and inputs from other kind of or tributaries that come into Peru Creek. So it didn't improve water quality as far downstream as we had hoped, but we did see at least a local improvement to the watershed. So effects, here's some loading kind of numbers. You can see these are all post-bulkhead construction as compared to the 2009 baseline. You can see pretty consistent load reductions across the board for most metals. Some obviously a bigger improvement, some somewhat, you know, 33% zinc isn't as much as we had hoped. But some of the others we had pretty significant improvements in terms of total load downstream. So relatively happy with the results, but with anything it's somewhat mixed, and we'll see over time what we actually get. So pin mine bulkhead results, eliminated portal blowout or surge events, and then reduced surface discharge at the mine portal, reduced downstream loading of most metals, and then really reduced long-term O&M, we think, by installing bulkheads that are somewhat walk away. I'm not going to say completely walk away because Christoph wouldn't let me, but at least there are situations where we don't have to do as much active work on the site. We do have some increased flow at a spring above the mine portal. We'll see what happens over time. But as I mentioned with bulkheads, it's really a long-term monitoring situation to understand those full impacts. So that's all I have. Any questions from the audience?
Yes. There have been a number of questions coming in as you were speaking. I think one is pretty well related to some of the statements that you just made. This person wanted to know, you know, so when a state goes in and installs a bulkhead at an abandoned mine and there's a remaining discharge of water, how is that water discharge dealt with? And also, is there a permit required to do this?
That's a good question. And potentially, yes, on the permit required. At this point in time, it's kind of a long-term situation where we're monitoring what those impacts are going to be and whether or not there's going to need to be, whether there's going to be a need for some kind of long-term passive treatment. And that's one of the things that Christoph did discuss is now that the flow is reduced, we have a much broader spectrum of passive treatment options that we can look at the site. And so that was somewhat contemplated based on the fact that we knew we're not going to get all the flow addressed, and so passive is one of those options, but we really need to have a good understanding of kind of what the long-term impact and flow rate is going to be. So it's that is a challenge.
Okay. Another question that was specific to the De Niro-Nelson groundwater interaction, and this person states that it's an example of how long to monitor for a stable system related to a bulkhead. And the person states that oftentimes a bulkhead is a first step towards a decision related to future water treatment. And this person is just wondering, so how long do you wait for a bulkhead to settle out within, you know, a range of chemistry, pressures, discharges, before asking the question, is the next step, do we now need to consider water treatment?
I don't want to cop out by saying it's site-specific, but I think on some of the slides that I showed, you can see at least in terms of pressure and mine pool, you get a pretty good sense of when it's reached a steady-state condition, and that does somewhat vary, but you know, it looked like it was about 1 to 3 years on both of our sites. At De Niro, it did take, you know, 4 years really to begin to see impacts in the adjacent mine tunnel and within the adjacent receiving streams. But it's so site-specific in terms of how quickly you know that impact, which is why this monitoring component is so critical in being able to establish a longer-term monitoring plan at the site. But most of the sites, we're monitoring at least or hoping to monitor at least 10 years to get some sense of what those impacts are. But it is so site-specific just based on what the geology and the mine workings and how connected they are.
Okay, that makes sense. I think we should move on to Joy's presentation, and then we can continue with more questions and answers after she shows us her talk.
Okay, thank you. I'm Joy Jenkins, and I'm with EPA in Region 8, and I'm a remedial project manager in the Superfund program. And we're going to go through another case study, and this one is about the Big Five tunnel in-tunnel treatment system at the Captain Jack Mill Superfund site. Okay, first I'll go through some background and site history. We'll talk about our mine water remedy, the concepts and the features of that remedy. We'll go over some results of that initial operation. And then a little foreshadowing here, we'll talk about the problem solving we had to do because conditions did not react as we anticipated. And then we'll go through our next steps for continuing to work on effective implementation of our remedy. So this is a NPL site or a Superfund site, National Priorities List site. This site was a gold and silver mining and milling area. Activity started here in the 1860s and actually went intermittently through as recently as 1992. The most recent mining and milling in the area was sort of a a small shop of two guys in a shovel sort of situation, and they were asked to cease and desist by the state in 1992. So the elevation of this site is about 8,500 feet to 9,000 feet above sea level. It's a pretty small area, and the major features of this site are they span less than about a mile to a mile and a half. The Big Five Tunnel, in this case, is the adit that is draining acid mine drainage into Left Hand Creek. And as Christoph talked about, tunnels tend to have two openings, and adits only have one. However, the miners often named a structure a tunnel if they were using it for ore haulage or drainage. And so a lot of the mine maps will call something a tunnel, even where technically it's an adit. And then as us at EPA and communicating with folks in the surroundings, we often use that word interchangeably. So you mine engineers, don't criticize me for using tunnel when it's really an adit. So the main contaminants of concern here are cadmium, copper, manganese, and zinc. There is some variability in those concentrations and seasonal variability. And we've also had some variability in that pH range. We've seen the maximum low prior to the remedy was about 2.6, and some seasonal changes with high pH of about 4.5. So generally, we thought the site had relatively low flows, a base flow of 20 to maybe 40 gallons per minute, with a peak seasonal spring runoff flows just up to 160 gallons per minute. So this site is really close to Denver, where the EPA Region 8 office is, as well as our state partner, Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment. We both sit in Denver. This site's a little less than 50 miles away. It's near the small town of Ward, which I have a photo of that. It's a historic mining town as well. And so this looked like a great opportunity for a location to implement a novel treatment technology. So we'll go through what that technology is. So the record of decision for the NPL site was decided in 2008, and it included an in-situ or in-tunnel treatment system to treat that acid mine drainage water. The concept here was to submerge the mineralized zones in order to minimize the contact with oxygen by impounding water behind an engineered bulkhead. And as we all know, oxygen diffuses much more slowly through water than it does through air. And my chemistry background from undergrad makes me want to put in an equation. This is our generalized equation for acid mine drainage generation. You get pyrite, mix it with some oxygen and water, you come out with ferric iron and a lot of sulfuric acid. So the concept here is reduce oxygen, reduce your sulfuric acid. The remedy concept also included the ability to neutralize the impounded mine pool water. The objective here, again, was the same idea. Use the pH increase to help slow that oxidation, slow those leaching reactions, and reduce the metal solubility in general. The remedy included a recirculation provision and an option to add organic carbon to potentially drive biological sulfate reduction to sulfide generation and sulfide metals precipitation. So I'll go through some of the details of the components. This included a concrete bulkhead with a stainless steel piping and valve system so that water could be released to manage that water level in the mine pool. There was a 220-foot section of tunnel that was packed with gravel-sized crushed limestone, gravel-sized limestone, and this was located just in by of that concrete bulkhead. And this was expected to provide some initial neutralization as the mine pool started to develop. The recirculation system was to allow water to be pumped from just in by of the bulkhead to a borehole intersecting the tunnel up gradient approximately 900 feet away. And the goal here was to be able to move neutralized water from that limestone section or any other amendments we might add up to the up gradient portion of the mine pool that we couldn't otherwise access besides through boreholes. This remedy included some flexibility, capability to add liquid caustic or sodium hydroxide if additional neutralization was needed. It also has an option through the same boreholes to add liquid or slurried organic carbon to promote that sulfate reduction potentially. So our initial operation strategy, though, was to try and employ what we saw as the simplest method first, and that was perceived to be flooding and then initial limestone neutralization, and then the plan was to adjust the system as needed. So I'll go through a little bit of the system layout here. And so over on the right-hand side of the screen, we have the left-hand creek. And then up from that, there's two settling ponds that received water from the Big Five tunnel. And our bulkhead is located about 600 feet back from that tunnel portal. And you'll remember that picture from Christoph's presentation about the various fracture zones and higher permeability areas. So this was approximately the same area that we found to have the least fracture zones. This is on vein here, so we did have to deal with that in our concrete bulkhead design. This, right in by of that, is our limestone pile. And then just in by of the bulkhead is this borehole, which contains the recirculation pump. It pumps water through a buried pipeline and delivers the water back into the tunnel, and that's approximately a little less than 900 feet away. So these are just some pictures from Remedy installation. This is our, before I started this project, I had no idea how we were going to get limestone into the tunnel, but the in-tunnel contractors know how to do this sort of work. They used a mucker to pack this section of tunnel with limestone, and they were able to get about 2 feet from the tunnel ceiling. So we felt like we got a good amount of potential alkalinity generation in that tunnel. We'll go through a little bit of the concrete bulkhead design. I mentioned it's a little less than 600 feet in by of the portal. If you can remember back from two slides ago, that location was also about 200 feet below ground, so that gave us sufficient ground to above the bulkhead to place the bulkhead there. And you'll also remember Christoph's slides with the three different types of bulkhead design. We used a slab keyed into the bedrock here, and our parameters here, this bulkhead was designed pretty conservatively for the conditions. We knew that there's not only our borehole that we installed, but there was another shaft that had potential connectivity that was about 200 feet from above the surface of the shaft, and the borehole that we installed was 200 feet or so above the tunnel floor. So that would be our maximum water level here that this mine pool could ever hold. However, we did over-design this, or conservatively design this bulkhead, and we put in a 15-foot long bulkhead, concrete bulkhead, and the keyed sections were 6 feet wide and 3 feet tall, and that keyed in section goes the circumference of the bulkhead area. This bulkhead includes two stainless steel pipes. The lower pipe is the 12-inch pipe, and the upper pipe that we put towards the top of the bulkhead was only a 3-inch pipe, and the idea here is that we would use the 12-inch pipe for any sort of flow control that we want to do in the future. And our 3-inch pipe would be just a backup in case we got too much sludge buildup at our lower pipe. And you'll see in the construction design, we had to build to manage the water through the bulkhead, we built a small cofferdam and then put the piping structure with the perforated pipe to direct that water into a pipe while we were constructing the bulkhead. So, of course, once you construct a bulkhead, that cofferdam and perforated pipe is in place now. You'll never go back and get at that. And so you have to make sure that's going to work for you in the long-term operation of your system. Okay, here's just some photos to kind of build on some of the photos that Jeff had in his presentation as well. Here, the underground crew is injecting grout, preparing that curtain grout in the bulkhead area, in the future bulkhead area. The middle picture, here's our 12-inch stainless steel pipe. You're looking at the crew is basically standing in the excavated area of the keyed out area for the future bulkhead. You see the formwork in the back, and that'll be the waterside formwork. Got our upper pipe here. In the far right picture, you're looking at the completed bulkhead, and again, you're seeing some of those contact grout pipelines still in place. and then we have our stainless steel pipes and valves. Okay, speaking of pipes and valving systems, this is the place where you get your pipe and valve experts on board. In this case, for this particular situation, we knew we wanted to be able to adjust or regulate flow from the bulkhead pipes. And as folks in the piping and valving system arena know, that you know, many valves are not made for flow regulation. They're made for on-off. And if you use them in flow regulation, you can get cavitation or destruction of your materials in that valve. And so the pressure changes in the flow reduction application can cause this. So you have to consider, you know, what are my long-term maintenance considerations when I need to regulate flow. So the solution in this case was to put in a primary, so here's the bulkhead over on the right side. We put in primary isolation valves, and these are primarily to be used in an on-off knife gate valve, to be used in an on-off position. And then we installed a secondary flow control, specialized flow control valve. And in this case, it's a Fisher ET flow control valve. We also use piping reduction to be able to install that flow control valve and be able to knock down the pressure coming from the bulkhead to get the flows that we wanted to see out of here. And so this setup allows us to, over time, you know, maintenance might be needed on these valves. The flow control valves might need to be replaced. That isolation valve lets us easily replace the flow control valve and sets us up pretty good for future maintenance. And of course, all of these parts were for 316 stainless. And in this case, we used a conservative design, and we did use the 250 PSI isolation valve pressure rating. All right, so this is just a little bit brighter picture with the completed bulkhead. Here's our lower pipeline, big isolation valve, flow control valve, and then we moved from the stainless steel into HDPE piping to convey that water out to the portal. And you'll see, as Christoph and Jeff both pointed out, there's places where there's still some drippy water after you build your bulkhead. It's often not completely dry. So this is nuisance water. We were able to manage this a little bit better as we went on. This was just my nicest and brightest photo that I have. So we installed the system. So the question, what happened next? Well, we closed the valves in spring of 2018. And this system filled pretty fast. It filled faster than we had anticipated based on what we understood the flow rates to be. In about 4 months, water level rose about 160 feet, and that was measured by that borehole just in by of the bulkhead where I said the recirculation pump was located. The height to the top of casing of that borehole was about 198 feet. So as we were watching the real steep part of this curve happen, we started to get uncomfortable about water coming out of our borehole, or if not there, the shaft, the California rays, that's not too far from this location. So we opened those valves in September of 2018 in a controlled fashion. We used our flow regulation to maintain that water level for a while and prevent any further increase in that mine pool level. So what happened in this scenario, at least in this time frame, you know, we had an assumption that our mine pool would equilibrate with the surroundings, and that just didn't appear to happen. We had other monitoring wells, and none of our other monitoring systems showed any significant migration of water into the nearby surrounding ground, nor did we see it equilibrate at a steady level. Not shown on this graph, but there was a point where we had to close the valve again, and we saw a steep increase again from this point up. And so we didn't see that equilibration in this time frame with any of our surroundings. So we were sampling several of our boreholes, but we had three locations where we could sample water. The key location, we have a borehole about 300 feet in by the bulkhead, and this is in the area of that packed limestone section of the tunnel. So we had really good water quality there. We were seeing pH above 6, we were seeing low conductivity. It seemed like we were getting this positive impact from the limestone. But we thought it was anomalous that our sample port on our bulkhead was having a lower pH. So we thought, oh, we're just not moving water. We've got some, you know, preferential flow path or something like that. Well, it turns out that we realize our sampling techniques of our borehole were not keeping up with the changing water level. So we weren't getting representative sampling from our boreholes over that summer period that we had the valves closed. So to identify this specifically, what happened is we employed an Aquastar pH probe, and we dropped that pH probe down, pH and conductivity, down the depth of the borehole, taking readings at various intervals. And you can see from the top down, we got nice above pH 6 water. And then about 60 feet above the floor of the bulkhead, we had a significant decline in pH, and then it shot down to a little less than 3. And the same story happened, similar story with conductivity, pretty low conductivity, everything was looking pretty good, and then you get this pretty significant chemocline in the borehole, where you suddenly get into this higher conductivity water indicative of your acid-mine drainage. So we saw this really significant stratification in our monitoring boreholes that our sampling technique wasn't capturing. So we had thought our water quality was much better than it was. And the other reason we were led to believe this is when we first put in that limestone, we put in the bulkhead, we closed those, or we had the valves open, so there was just a couple feet of water running through the limestone. That limestone was giving us a really positive impact. I think we'd created a really nice anoxic limestone drain in that situation. And so for about a year and a half, while water was running through that limestone through open valves, we had really good water quality. And so that made us believe the results that we were seeing in the tunnel with our sampling down the boreholes. But what had really happened is our water quality had gotten much worse in this time. So the table here on the left side shows our that middle column is the maximum concentration of our pre-remedy conditions from about 2014, 2016. And then the maximum concentration over in this column after our valve closure, this is just one sampling point. This isn't averaged over time. I actually picked up the worst water quality we saw. But you can see that in that time frame of about 4 months of the valves being closed, you know, we saw order of magnitude increase in metals in the water in the samples right behind our bulkhead. So this was surprising to us. This was unexpected. Our pH at that particular point in time didn't change that much from our lowest pH we'd seen before. We did subsequently in another month sample, we did see some lower pHs in the next following months, but actually not consistent with worsening metals concentration. But what we think is likely to have happened is just the flushing and dissolution of acidic metal-laden salts when the subsurface is wetted. And, you know, as folks that work in this field, this is a typical phenomenon that you can see in waste rock piles with spring flush. You know, over the winter, as snow melt trickles through a waste rock pile or an ore pile, you can see, or tailings pile, you can pick up some acid mine drainage, that water evaporates, salts, acidic metal-laden salts are evaporated onto the rock, and then you come through with your spring flush and you flush them out. So this is not an unheard of phenomena, but I think what happened here is the order of magnitude change was really unexpected, and we didn't have any sort of, we didn't have any signals that we had saw prior to flooding of the bulkhead to give us some indication that this would happen. Another question that we have, too, is, you know, well, probably flushing of these salts was a significant contributor, but was there also acid mine drainage generation still occurring while we were flooding the tunnel? So then we're into problem-solving mode. We have a mine pool that's getting higher. We have water quality that's worse than it was before. And so EPA emergency response mobilized a temporary external line treatment system to manage the mine pool level and allow discharge of treated water. And of course, these things happen in winter. So starts to snow, we were able to, with our emergency response team and their contractors, we were able to put in an effective lime treatment system that was able to operate in all sorts of inclement conditions. Some additional problem solving we did is we took that flexibility we had in our remedy design and we added that liquid sodium hydroxide. It was 25% sodium hydroxide. We added that into that upgradient borehole that was about 900-ish feet from the bulkhead. And we also increased our recirculation rate in attempt to mix that sodium hydroxide. We did set up a test where we took an auto sampler at the bulkhead. We were trying to see if we could use the sodium as a tracer and see how well that sodium hydroxide was moving around. We saw sodium at an increase at the bulkhead in the time we were doing that testing, but we also saw a blob, a technical term, a big puddle of sodium hydroxide that sat at the bottom of the tunnel where at the borehole, at the borehole location where we added it. And you can see our graphs on the right-hand side here. We did, again, took that Aquastar pH and conductivity probe, dropped it down at intervals. This is a different scale here in this graph than in the, a couple slides ago. We were, you know, consistently pH 3 down that borehole. And then about two feet or so from the tunnel bottom in this particular instance, you know, we had a rapid increase of pH. This one went up to 9. We've got other instances where we could see pH of 13 from our sodium hydroxide just tending to puddle there. And it's the same story with the conductivity, pretty low, you know, acid mine drainage-like conductivity, and then a significant increase that would be indicative of that 25% sodium hydroxide just sitting there. So, and this is another interesting phenomena with our pH probes is, you know, then on the way up, the red dots are on the way down, blue dots are on the way up. I think we were drawing along some of that sodium hydroxide with us, or we just caused the pH probe to go a little out of whack with such significant changes and a little dip into sodium hydroxide. So, you know, the recirculation system, we seem to have limited success in mixing in this scenario, and this is very different than what we'd seen when we had just a couple feet of water in the tunnel. We had, you know, pretty solid plug flow when we did our initial tracer test, but that didn't seem to play out once we've increased the level of water in this mine tunnel system. So our current objective is to bring that mine pool back down to historic water levels as well as corresponding historic water quality is our hope. And the objective here is to buy us some time to reevaluate this in-tunnel approach. So current conditions or relatively recent conditions, you know, we did see from that, this is the same table I showed you a couple slides ago with our pre-remedy column, the maximum concentrations that we saw in the fall of 2018, and then here's some data from August of 2019, so just a 2 months ago or so. And so we've seen a real significant decrease again in those metals concentrations. So, you know, the kind of leads us to believe that this was a flushing of those acidic salts. The middle column was 151 feet, and then this more recent sample was at 34 feet. So, you know, maybe if we would be able to let this system play out, we'd see a decrease of those metals again. But we wanted to manage that mine pool more effectively and more actively, at least in the temporary time frame. And so we also think that maybe our flow monitoring from the past, you know, they were periodic spot measurements. You think you see some consistency and you think it's real consistent. But considering our variety of treatment rates we've had to keep increasing to really draw down this mine pool, you know, possibly either the system changed or we really thought the system flows were lower than we'd been able to capture with the sampling we'd done. So currently, this week, or I guess last week, we actually hit our back to our historic mine pool level of less than 3 feet. So we're getting back to those objectives of trying to reevaluate this in-tunnel treatment remedy. And so that's exactly what our next steps are, is we'll be considering approaches for adding organic carbon to drive some biological sulfate reduction. We'll be looking at reevaluating that recirculation and mixing capabilities in a mine tunnel system. Doesn't seem to behave as we would have anticipated from our initial studies. We're going to be considering what external treatment needs that we need to have on hand while implementing an in-tunnel treatment system in this situation, particularly with that understanding that we're not getting a really quick equilibration of this water with the surroundings, and we do have that risk of water coming out of a shaft or, you know, our own boreholes, we could put packers in them, but the mine shaft that the California raised that may be connected, you know, we don't have a great ability to plug off water there. So I put kind of this funny picture on the right-hand side here, you know, is there light at the end of the tunnel for acid mine drainage water sources? And because of the long-term costs that the active water treatment has for, you know, mining companies, for taxpayers of the federal and state governments. Both the EPA and our state partners think that it is worth the potential cost savings of internal treatment over external active treatment, that it's worth continuing to work on this in-tunnel treatment concept and try and deal with these challenges that were presented in this case to try and get an effective in-tunnel treatment process in place. This also gives us this experience at the site and the amount of sampling that we did collect. It does give us an opportunity to use forensics to create a predictive tool for trying to understand how does water quality change upon flooding in the future. And so we'll be looking back at what information we have at this site that we can wrap into looking to be predictive to be used at other sites. We'll be working on developing a geochemical model using the existing data here, as well as some additional sulfur isotope sampling that we plan to do to determine if that dissolution of the acidic salts was the main contributor of these metals increase in concentration, or if there is oxic or possibly anoxic pyrite oxidation that was a significant driver to that increase in metals concentration. We'll also be looking for a closer examination of the information we had about mineralogy, porosity, and flow paths to provide predictive information for other sites. And I'd like to use this as a tool to look at pre-flooding differences between high and low flow conditions for pH and metals concentrations and see if those could be indicative of changes that may occur upon flooding. And ideally, I see this as if we were able to get sufficient data from other sites where we had the pre and post flooding water quality conditions, can we use that information to get some predictive tools together. So if you are in possession of that data and would like to share, we can work on how we might put some information together to look at how these mine tunnels behave after flooding from what we might have known beforehand. So to wrap up our three presentations today, we've got just some concluding thoughts and questions, just hitting on some of the points that that one of the three of us have spoken about, or all of us have spoken about so far. And I think the big thing you see with these case studies is, not all mine sites are the same. One solution doesn't fit all. They might all behave a little differently after you put in a bulkhead. The idea of characterizing the mine system and surrounding areas to the extent feasible, including groundwater and mine system hydrology, geology and mineralogy, all of your existing water quality loading from the tunnel itself, but also from the watershed and the nearby areas that could be impacted by your bulkhead, both positively or negatively. So another concept we brought out today is establishing reasonable goals for that bulkhead. Are you trying to just do flow control that's preventing burps or sudden releases? Are you using it for temporary storage that maybe is helping you reduce loading at certain times or certain seasons, or temporary storage to help you feed into a treatment system? Or are you really trying to plug a pathway completely? So water may come out somewhere else. Determine if that's going to be a good or a bad thing. Maybe it's going to come in a place that it's more easy to manage than it is in its current exit location from the mountain. And where in the watershed are you trying to reduce metals? Are there other lines of evidence that you can predict what the water quality changes are going to be after flooding? And I think that's the place that I'd like to look into more thoroughly. And will those lower or controlled valve or flows that you might have on a valved bulkhead or a bulkhead that sends water somewhere else, is that going to help you put in a passive treatment, make that more of a feasible option over active treatment? Maintenance is generally required, so think about that as you're doing your design. What maintenance are you going to require? What's that long-term fate of the bulkhead going to be? And overall, bulkhead effectiveness may require years to establish. And this has been a question that some of the participants have asked, is how long will it take? And like Jeff had indicated, it's site-specific. So those are just some concepts we had, and thanks for your attention today. We appreciate the opportunity to present this information, and I think we have just a very few minutes for questions.
Great. Thank you very much. There was a lot of great information shared and lots of questions coming in. So let's see if we can take a couple of them here. Someone had a very specific question wanting to know about what was the rock type at the bulkhead and how much grout was needed in the grout curtain.
And is that specific to Captain Jack?
Yeah, this question came in while you were speaking, Joy.
Yeah, and you know, I don't have that handy in my head, so but feel free to use my contact information, and I can provide that information.
Okay, great. Yeah, and we're going to compile all the questions and share them with you guys, the speakers, because we're certainly not going to get to all of them today.
Yeah,
so the opportunity to respond back to them. We did get a number of questions related to cost, and I was wondering if you guys wanted to talk about how much putting in some of these systems has cost. Some of the specifics people have asked if you could provide a discussion on cost for the investigation, opening the workings, placing the bulkhead, and things like that.
This is Jeff. I can speak to certainly the Pennsylvania mine in terms of what the total costs were. We spent probably 2 to 3 years doing investigations at the site, and that involved a good bit of drilling, some tracer testing, and then we put in those two bulkheads on the lower tunnel and then actually an upper bulkhead on one of the upper tunnels. And I think including investigation, rehab, and bulkhead installation, we were pushing $2 million total on site, and that included everything. I think I showed in one of my slides what the actual bulkhead construction component of that was. Each of the bulkheads at the Penn mine that we installed was about $275,000 to install. So you can see that the bulkhead component of that whole site was probably only a third of the total cost. The investigation and then the rehab was the remaining two-thirds. And I think that's pretty typical on a lot of these sites.
Okay. Did Christoph or Joy, did you want to add anything else to that?
No, I think Jeff covered it well. A big thing really is how much rehab does it take to get to the actual bulkhead placement? So, yeah, definitely agree with that.
Okay. Great. I think this one last question I'm going to ask is a good way to try to summarize some things from you guys. This person wants to know if you could refer us to some of the best information out there to look at to learn more about bulkhead design.
There's not a whole lot published, to be honest. I mean, it's somewhat in-house. I don't know if that's the right term for it. But there's a couple of different papers. I know John Abel was one of the original kind of guys that came up with the process for bulkhead design, certainly for abandoned mine tunnels. So I believe he has some publications out there back from the 90s. I don't know what you've used in the past, Christoph. There's a few publications, but there's definitely not a clearinghouse for that information.
Right. The most rigorous kind of the real scientific studies of bulkheads, that took place about the 1950s, 1960s in South Africa, and where they had a whole lot of very, you know, controlled scientific experiments on that with different grout levels and that, and they came up with a lot of design criteria that was then adopted by the Bureau of Mines in the U.S. in like the early 80s, I think, and then built on a bit more by John Abel as what Jeff was talking about. You know, and there's also stuff in the literature on hydroelectric projects, just because, you know, your axis adits hydroelectric projects require some pretty intense bulkheads and that. But, you know, a lot of this, you know, a lot of it is, you know, very site-specific, unique design. I mean, it's all custom. It's definitely not, mm-hmm. you know, here's your standard bulkhead slab, throw it in there.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I think that now we can add the archive of this webinar to the list of references that people can use to learn more about bulkheads. I want to thank all of you, Christoph, Jeff, and Joy, for your excellent presentation. I was not only seeing comments of gratitude within the webinar, but people were sending me private messages saying how wonderful this was. So thank you for taking the time with sharing your knowledge, and it's very appreciated, and I know people will be watching this archive over and over. So thank you so much. And with that, I'm going to turn it to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I'm going to walk through just a few quick reminders. For those of you that found this to be an informative seminar, I'll just remind everyone that we have webinars like this advertised on the Cleanup Information Network, as well as a variety of other resources to for mining sites, as Michelle highlighted earlier. So I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org or sign up for a free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and lists upcoming webinars such as today's. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, again, we already have those posted under the resources link. It's on the middle right of your screen right now under related URLs. I've also included it under the Q&A window, so you can click on either one of those links to browse to the page and actually download the materials. Contact information for our presenters and organizers is also available on the seminar homepage, but as Michelle noted, we'll be compiling these questions and working to get them to the instructors so that we can try to get additional follow-up with each of you. I will ask each of you to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in terms of the materials as well as the content that was presented today. One of the most frequent questions I get as a session moderator is if we offer credit hours or certificates. While we don't issue CEUs or PDHs for our sessions, you can get a participation certificate after you submit feedback for the session. So if you follow the link under related URLs or in the Q&A window to our feedback form and you submit feedback, making sure to check the box at the very bottom of the seminar certifying you were here for the whole thing. As long as you enter your email address correctly on that form, as soon as you submit it, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that looks something like this that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you participated in a group in today's webinar, each person in the room can actually fill out that feedback form on their own to get their own certificate, even if you didn't each individually register. So I'll ask those of you who did sign up, if you shared the room with others, please be sure to share the feedback form link with your colleagues who joined you so they can get their own certificate and give us their thoughts on the session as well. As Michelle noted, this webinar in the series of mining events that we've been hosted has been recorded and will be available for on-demand playback in approximately 1 week. All of the registrants will get an email as soon as that archive is available. And so with that, I will echo the thanks to everyone who joined us, as well as those of you who stayed on for a few additional extra minutes here to close things out. We'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you again so very much for joining us.